on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded January 15th, 2025. Well, for any who believed or hoped beyond hope, the years intervening his second coming would have mellowed the once and future American president, early indications are not encouraging. Donald Trump has thundered and threatened both friend and foe, promising his wrath will shake the pillars of the earth to realize a newer world order, come hell and high waters, or words to make that effect. For Canadians, Mexicans, Cubans, and Panamanians, those promises are of immediate concern, but likewise for all who stand in the way of empire's wavering hegemony. Professor Jeremy Kuzmarov is a scholar, journalist, and author who writes for and serves as managing editor to Covert Action magazine. Kuzmarov's book titles include Obama's Unending Wars, The Russians Are Coming Again, written with John Marciano, and his latest, Warmonger, How Clinton's Malign Foreign Policy Launched the U.S. Trajectory from Bush 2 to Biden. Jeremy's most recent article at CAM is Mass Incarceration Arose Out of Empire Building Across North America, Caribbean, and Pacific. And it's easy to forget, almost 3 years along, there was a time before the Russia-Ukraine war. But make no error, those weren't halcyon days. The absence of war did not make a peace. Instead, it was the period of war's long slogging preparation, when falsity and treachery conspired to ready the conditions for the destruction of a nation. And that conspiracy continues. John Helmer's a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest levels, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among his many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, the lately released autobiography Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes, Skripal in Prison, the first and perhaps only book to follow the Skripal saga from its beginnings, and now its freshly released sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. John's recent article, Writing on the Kremlin Wall, Is It Strategy or Alibi?, examines Russia's strategic retreat from Syria. John Helmer and spitting out the red, white, and blue pills in the second half. But first, Jeremy Kuzmarov and counting down to the Donald's return. Welcome back to the program, Jeremy.
My pleasure, always, to be with you.
Well, it's my great pleasure to have you, of course. Now, Jeremy, Monday, CAM hosted Intelligence Agencies and Trump, What Can We Expect?, a webinar featuring former FBI and CIA employees divining entrails for portents of the anticipated events to come. You were there moderating. So, Jeremy, how spaketh the Harris species? What can we expect of Trump?
Well, there is some unpredictability in Trump, but my assessment and a lot of the others was, it's kind of business as usual. I mean, Trump presented himself as this foe of the deep state and victim of it, and then he was trying to, take on the deep state. But I think a lot of that was political theater, and in many ways, he's a pretty clever politician, as vulgar and off-putting a person as he is. I mean, he played off the public disaffection with the intelligence agencies and covert operation that made it seem like he was the primary victim and made it seem like only the Democratic Party is connected with the deep state, not the Republican Party. And I mean, you can look at his appointment of the CIA director, John Ratcliffe, worked for John Ashcroft, notorious attorney general who promoted torture. Ratcliffe is a China hawk. He's an Iran hawk. He'd been spreading disinformation that Iran was out to get Trump and certain black rumors. It's a trademark of the CIA to spread false rumors to turn public opinion against enemy nations. Now, I mean, there may be some hope with regard to Ukraine conflict that Trump will be pivoting more to China and to Iran and continuing to support Israel's rampage across the Middle East. So there is some hope with the new administration as far as resolving potentially the Ukraine Ukraine conflict, although if you look at Trump's first term, he basically continued the policy of the Obama administration of escalation vis-a-vis Russia, expansion of sanctions, expansion of military aid to Ukraine. The one wild card is Tulsi Gabbard, who had more of a pacifist outlook and has often called out the lies of intelligence agencies, like with regard to Syrian chemical weapons attacks, and called for investigation into to biolabs, has been against the Patriot Act and forever wars and you know, runaway surveillance. So we'll see if she gets in. I mean, you know, she could have a positive impact, maybe changing things about how the intelligence agencies have been operating and manipulating public opinion. So there is some hope with her if she can get in. I mean, she's faced a significant backlash, and already I think she's backtracking on one or two of her previous positions. So we'll see how that plays out.
Well, when you say that Trump is theatrical, I think he probably epitomizes that description. But then again, how many presidents aren't nowadays? Isn't that sort of a necessity of the presidency? How much, Jeremy, do you think it matters whether it's Biden or Trump or Clinton or anybody else when it comes to especially foreign policy?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I think in many ways we have a uniparty, you know, and that was evident to many people when they showed that footage from Jimmy Carter's funeral, and you had Trump and Obama laughing and best of friends, and you know, George W. Bush was close with Michelle Obama. So, I mean, really, you know, these kind of ideological divisions and you know, supposed hatreds and partisan politics. I mean, a lot of it is just for show, you know, for the public, and it's part of really a kind of divide and conquer strategy, and it's really a uniparty of financial elites who really run the show, and the presidents, I mean, they're beholden to those financial elite. They pay for their campaign. They provide them the billions of dollars, and they want a return on their investment. You know, they want an open door foreign policy, pushing for you know, free trade and, you know, investment around the world and more warfare. You know, they profit off wars, so that they want to continue this drumbeat for war, the demonization of Russia, China, Iran, continued escalation against those countries. So I agree with that premise. Yeah, a lot of the politics we see are just kind of theater. And the key, you know, financial elites are running the show, and they're the one pushing us to the brink of World War III. I don't know about Trump himself. I mean, he comes across more as just a kind of business opportunist who only cares about his own wealth and aggrandizement. But among his followers, and I think, I mean, Reagan at least conveyed the impression that he was a true believer in American exceptionalism and in capitalism as a system that could uplift the poor, and this kind of deep ideological belief in the evil of communism and left-wing systems, that they're antithetical to prosperity. So you do have that among sectors of the American elite, and you had it in Reagan. Maybe, I don't know about Trump, but definitely some of his supporters.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Jeremy Kuzmarov. He is a scholar, journalist, and author who writes for and serves as managing editor to Covert Action magazine. His book titles include Obama's Unending Wars, The Russians Are Coming Again, that with John Marciano, and his latest is Warmonger, How Clinton's Malign Foreign Policy Launched the U.S. Trajectory from Bush 2 to Biden. We're talking today in and around his latest article, Mass Incarceration Arose Out of Empire Building Across North America, Caribbean, and Pacific. You know, Jeremy, when you talk about Reagan, and I'm still fumbling with this idea of how presidents present themselves and how and what they believe, he presented himself as the cowboy. He loved horses. That was genuine enough. And he learned to ride expertly while he was a movie actor in Hollywood. But in his early political years, he was seen on his horse, but dressed in the English style, a very posh and upper class, like he's ready to go on the hunt, you know, the fox hunt or some such thing. And his handler said, no, that is not going to fly in Peoria. And they dressed him up as a cowboy. And he was the cowboy ever after. When we looking at somebody like Trump and you say, well, you know, he's this business guy, that, you know, easy to understand. He's crude. He's rude. And he just cares about himself. I wonder if there isn't more depth to him, though, if there isn't an essence of a class warrior. It looks seems to me what we're looking at, not only in North America, but around the world, the Western world, such as it is really a return to the feudal times. And it's a class war, the next world war.
I think so. There's a good book by David Gibbs called Revolt of the Rich. And he looks, it's a new book, I think Columbia University Press. And he starts in the 70s, you know, and he looks at the rise of the 60s movements. And they're really, you know, challenging the power that be and pushing for, you know, more social democratic order and, you know, an end to the warfare state. And then the rich, you know, saw this as a threat, and also, you know, it coincided with declining, you know, profits for a variety of reasons that he explains. And so, yeah, he argues that they waged a vigorous class war and imposed a neoliberal economic austerity program, starting with Carter. And he actually has a good analysis of how Carter was a key president in the transition from a more social democratic state of the New Deal era to the unfettered capitalism, or, you know, in a way, neo-feudalism, as you describe it, of this second Gilded Age in American history. And it started with Carter, who deregulated a lot of industry and began a war on organized labor that Reagan continued when he fired all the air traffic controllers when they went on strike. And this was all a class war of the rich to destroy organized labor, to deregulate the economy, empower corporations. And it coincided also with the growth of mass incarceration, with, you know, huge underclasses and unemployment. The only thing to do is lock them up. So you declare war on drugs and they're out of sight. And I think, yeah, a lot of the culture began as demonization of the poor, blaming them for their conditions. And you had all these shows like Jerry Springer that came up that showed poor people looking terrible and all these kind of pathologies. So I think that fed into the ruling ideology that the poor in America were just unintelligent and irredeemable.
Yeah. And even before that, as far as the media goes, and there, I was listening to some interesting discussions about how media was employed in at the time of Carter, after the Church Commission, to rehab the CIA. And if you look at television today, it's there are heroes, these spies and that, and their popularity and trust numbers were much higher in America. They're starting to descend now again. But how the American television typified rural America with, like, the Beverly Hillbillies and stuff like this, where they were, you know, good people but kind of stupid and in need of a minding.
Yeah, I think that those are stereotypes. I mean, they may run deep, but I mean, the traditional, you know, Horatio Alger story was that if you work hard, you know, you can get ahead in America. And you know, some show did depict, you know, the American dream. But yeah, this was kind of the inverse of the American dream. And it supported, yeah, this kind of rigid class system that really in many ways is un-American, because many Americans, settlers who came to the New World were escaping the rigid class hierarchy that prevailed in Europe. And America was supposed to be a more free society with more social mobility. So this ruling ideology and mindset that has taken root in many ways is antithetical to the actual ideals of the country. And that's why, yeah, many of these people are really enemy. I mean, they're traitors to the United States. You know, they sold the interests of the American people, whether it's allowing the offshoring of manufacturing to make yet more profits, or sending American boys to die in senseless wars for oil and profits in the Middle East. I think Trump and that class should be viewed as traitors of the United States, and their ideology has little to do with what the country was founded for.
Well, now, Jeremy, right now here in Canada, and I can speak as a fellow Canadian to you, we have our millionaire son of a millionaire father, grandson of another millionaire. Mr. Trudeau is on his way out the door. People in Canada are worried about what they're hearing about the ascension of the next president down there. Rob Ford in Ontario has said that Trump's promise on day one to institute massive tariffs against Canada could cost maybe 500,000 jobs in Ontario alone. Do you think that this is just more theater, or is Trump serious about bringing Canada into a 51st state-like reality?
I don't think, not everything is theater. I mean, Trump has used the tariff. You know, the tariff is kind of a way to avoid these class divide that we're speaking of, or to enact real progressive policy, you know, to deal with the real social problems in the United States, including the decline of its manufacturing, decline of union jobs, and huge wealth inequality. Trump's solution to the tariff, instead of promoting higher wages, or taxing the wealthy more, or investing in civilian manufacturing, or offer incentives to undermine the war production and bolster civilian manufacturing. So tariff is like something the elite can get on board with. I mean, there's a tariff can be somewhat sensible policy as far as a way to stimulate or bring back some local industry. But yeah, it being used as a weapon, you see, like with Canada or China, they're trying to use tariffs as a weapon. And that, will have negative ramifications. And it also is creating bitterness toward the United States that may not be good for the United States. Like, in foreign policy, I mean, the U.S. has counted on Canada to just go along with everything that it's doing. But if it's going to wage war on the Canadian economy, then maybe a real populist leader, not a fake far-right figure like Pierre Poilievre, but a real Canadian nationalist along the model of a Pierre Elliott Trudeau would come about. And really try and assert Canada's independence from the United States. And that's something that would be highly welcome and is needed at this moment, because Canada has prostituted itself to the United States empire and just gone along with these bankrupt interventions, whether Ukraine or in the Middle East or in Latin America. U.S. is going to screw them over now. So now Canada should fight back.
We've seen that Justin Trudeau, the son of Pierre, went down to Mar-a-Lago, and it was kind of unclear. It wasn't what he was doing there, if he was going as a private citizen, or it wasn't set up as a state visit. This before he decided to throw in the towel. Now we've seen the Alberta premier go down as well, Danielle Smith, and we're not sure what she was talking about with Trump, but there's pictures of she and that guy from Shark Tank with Trump on the golf course, all having a great time, wondering, is this some kind of divide and conquer strategy by Trump to hive off the oil producing region of this country as they have done in Syria?
Yeah, well, that's true. Canadian politics has shifted far to the right, like American politics. So a lot of these leaders have really sold out their own population as well. I mean, Canada's faced austerity, budget cuts, rising military budgets. Its foreign policy has been tied to mining interests and as well as blind allegiance with the U.S. and its imperialistic operations. So, these kind of leaders, whether Trudeau or Alberta as a haven for the right wing, Canada, it's not been the finest hour for Canadian politics in the last 20 years or so. So, we need some real grassroots grassroots movements that will push for some real progressive policies and stand up to Trump and U.S. bullying.
When you were talking about the tariffs being used as weapons, that we've seen plenty of evidence of that over these last years, both under Trump and his successor Biden. Trump is president, and his presidential successor against Russia. Those seem to have largely backfired, as have the ones against China. But China and Russia are essentially de facto enemies of America. Now, when we're seeing Trump threaten Canada and Panama and Mexico and the European Union, he's threatening to treat friends the way he, so far, the Americans at least, have treated their enemies. What's this dynamic?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's a good look for the United States. I mean, and that's why many see the United States as a declining power, and it's going to become increasingly isolated. I mean, a good leader will try and build alliances and build coalitions. I mean, hopefully not to mobilize other countries to go to war, which is what often the United States has done. But yeah, I mean, that's just not a good governing strategy. The U.S. economy is dependent on trade with Canada and with Mexico, so alienating those countries further is just not good practice. And America is becoming more and more hated and feared around the world. And that's why, you know, many in the ruling elite are off put by Trump and don't like him because of those kind of practices, which isn't good for the overall health of the country. And, you know, and the pro-imperial elements don't like it either, because America has traditionally exhibited its global dominance by building coalitions. So this actually threatens the American empire project. And I guess you can say that's a good thing from our point of view, that project has been a very destructive one. But in general, it's just not good governing practice.
We're fast running out of time, Jeremy. Before we go now, you mentioned foreign policy under Trump as regards both Ukraine and Israel. There's been much made of some kind of rift between Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, and Trump. They've been closest of friends. Trump has delivered more than, as he says, and I think it's demonstrable, more for the state of Israel than any president prior. Is this to be believed, that there is some friction or tension or divide between American policy under Trump and Biden as regards Israel and its genocide come Holocaust in Palestine?
I don't think so. The way I see it, Israel basically a proxy of the United States, and the U.S. has used Israel to do a lot of the dirty work in the region. And the U.S. supports the project for greater Israel as a way to weaken and divide the Arab nations and expand American influence and power in the Middle East using Israel as its proxy. And the U.S. has military bases in Israel. There's very, very close collaboration between the U.S. military and intelligence services and Israeli military and intelligence services. So in a way, Israel's almost if Canada become the 51st state, Israel the 52nd state already. This is just, you know, yeah, I mean, maybe they don't agree on every single policy, or, you know, some of it may be for show. Like Biden, I think, was trying to, you know, it was like a political ploy to distance himself as the war and genocide was becoming more unpopular and arousing more protests. He wanted to distance himself publicly while the arms supplies were still open and expanding. So it was really meaningless if he voiced some concern over a particular policy or, you know, sought to distance himself. But, I mean, at the end of the day, they're providing the weapon that Israel needs to continue its military rampage. And basically, they've gone on a murder spree across the Middle East. And they were cheering, you know, the overthrow of the Assad government and triumph of al-Qaeda in Syria. Yeah. And their goal is to dismember Syria, weaken it, because Syria is a major enemy of Israel and also of the United States. The Ba'ath Party ruled Syria under the Assad for 50 years and were Arab nationalists and were seeking to reinvigorate Arab nationalism and support pan-Arabism. And now they've been defeated. and the country, they want to balkanize it and have it broken up. And Israel's already expanding its occupation beyond the Golan Heights. So this is a wet dream of the neoconservative fanatics who are in power in Israel and the United States. So, and they're working together.
Well, and quickly too, the now the talk of a ceasefire between Israel and Palestine, or the Hamas, as they say, but essentially Israel agreeing to stop dropping bombs on the civilian population. Do you think this is genuine, or is this just another one of those Israeli ceasefires that never seems to cease?
Yeah, well, it's small consolation for the Gazans when 90% of them have been displaced and, I don't know, maybe 100,000 or more killed. There's not much left to attack. What are they attacking at this point? They're attacking their own rubble, that they've turned the strip into a rubble. So, you know, if you've totally destroyed a place, I mean, Hamas may be operating out of Egypt or somewhere else. I don't think anybody, from my understanding, it's basically uninhabitable in the Gaza Strip. And all the toxins that have been unleashed from the weapons, you know, the Merchants of Death tribunal was going on, and they declared a guilty verdict of these corporations who supplied the weapons. And one guy was testifying about the environmental effects of the war in Gaza and all these toxic weapon system that had been unleashed, and the jet fuel that in itself has just destroyed the air and from all the residue from the bomb. I don't think anybody could live there in any health, and I don't know how any food is coming in. So, yeah, they basically completely destroyed a place. So you can have a ceasefire at this point, but you know, the damage, I think, has been done.
Scorched earth. Well, Jeremy, we're out of time. John Helmer's going to come straight up. We're going to talk about his new book, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. Jeremy, before we go, how do people get a hold of your website, Covert Action Magazine, get their hands on your book, read your latest article, Mass Incarceration Arose Out of Empire Building Across North America, Caribbean, and Pacific?
You can go to www.covertactionmagazine.com, or you can go to my Substack, Jeremy Kuzmarov at Substack, and it's too hot for the mainstream.
That's a good tagline. I'm going to steal that. And, yeah. And Jeremy, I wanted to, and I was remiss in not talking about the Merchants of Death. How, in a couple of seconds, what is it, and how do people find out more about the Merchants of Death?
If you go to merchantsofdeath.org, this was a 3-year project to expose the four major war profiteers: Boeing, General Atomics, Lockheed, and Raytheon. And their role in war crimes and profiteering off criminal wars. And they had dozens of hours of testimony by experts and on-the-ground witnesses of horrific war crime using these weapons, and showed how they willfully knew that these weapons were designed to kill. And they have killed in massive numbers, whether Gaza, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, General Atomics, the drone manufacturer. So anyway, they compiled all this evidence and testimony, and then the verdict was read guilty this morning. And they had people like Kathy Kelly, they had some international legal experts, and they hoped that this material could be used before the International Criminal Court and other legal bodies to hold accountable the war profiteers and the people in power who've organized these policies that have killed tens of thousands of people in the Middle East, in Ukraine, in Russia, and elsewhere.
Millions. Okay, Jeremy. Well, thanks a lot for coming on again, and we'll talk hopefully soon.
Absolutely.
As I said, John Helmer is coming up right after the break, so stick around for that.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York, Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago, Jakarta, Helsinki, Cape Town, Sao Paulo, Manchester, Bangalore, and somewhere in Russia I can't actually remember the name of.
Here in the Matrix, we're trained our whole lives to obey. Get up when the alarm goes off in the morning, go to work. you just might have to trade in your free will. You don't have to be captured by aliens for reality to be such a bitter pill. Here in the Matrix, the men in the ivory towers say we can remake the world around us if we put in the hours, if we work hard and play by the rules. It may not be true, but still, the fantasy is nicer when reality is such a bitter pill. Here in the Matrix, people argue about TV. Sometimes they complain about not enough diversity among the talking heads provided.